I think that in India, there was a great interest on the part of Christian missionaries to, well, convert Hindus to Christians. And much of what precipitated a lot of Indological scholarship was the work that these very missionaries did. They went over there, they said this should be a cinch, no problem, let's convert the heathens. And they went over there and they said, we have no problem accepting Jesus, but we don't have to get rid of what we do. India being what it is, very broad-minded, very inclusive, being sort of, they absorb, not so much exclude. So these Christian missionaries began to really think seriously about the depth of the tradition and pursuit of religion that was there, which kind of surprised them. They began putting together Sanskrit dictionaries. They began translating great sacred texts of India. And so much of my field owes a debt to these early Christian scholars, mostly, I think, German and English scholars, of whom Max Müller, for example, would be one of the leading ones. But anyway, all that being said, the interest in the Bhagavad Gita has been profound in the West. And to this day, there are scholars producing yet still other translations of the Bhagavad Gita. So here I am, one of them. I'm in this long tradition of scholars that try to get to the real essence of the text. And I have a colleague, Lori Patton, who is at Emory University, and she's coming out practically concurrently the same year with a translation. So hers is with Penguin, mine's with Harper. Both, you know, fairly, as you may know, very big presses, trade publishers. It's a little different feeling in both of those presses, but nonetheless, they will be very available editions. So my question was, when I started out with this Bhagavad Gita, you know, what is the Bhagavad Gita about? What does the Bhagavad Gita intend to say? This was an interesting exercise for me because I had studied the Gita for so long with what everyone else wishes to say with the Gita. So I wanted to find out, what does the Gita want to say? Is there a hermeneutic embedded within the text that tells us how it wants to be understood? I asked this question without knowing what the answer would be. Even though this is a text that I had read in Sanskrit and in English for so many years, from so many sectarian perspectives. So in my study of the Gita, I, you know, unearthed a lot of different things. First of all, one of the things I went through was, which I won't talk so much about tonight. I talked a little bit about it with you. But I'll be talking at Oxford about this. Why Another Translation of the Bhagavad Gita, Discoveries in Translation and Interpretation. And I have to say that the discoveries that I've been making over the past three years or so have been really quite unexpected and exhilarating, because I really didn't expect these things to come up. What I found was that the Gita really is self-referential. The Gita really does have something it wants to say. And that, and some of that message seems to be covered or secret or hidden by the very traditions that are very capable of representing it the most, namely the theistic Vaishnava traditions out of which clearly this text comes. So I was kind of fascinated about this and fascinated by what certain things in the Gita seem to be missed that only would promote these very visions. So, very fascinated with this. And in the process also, and again, I won't talk about this particular aspect, but I had to unlearn so much of what I learned in Sanskrit in graduate school and both the schools I went to. And I developed in the process really a new way of translating this great text, spirituality. So what we've got here then is something then that challenged me on a hermeneutical level, challenged me on a theological level. What was being said? One of the things that I think is important to realize when we read any text, a text sometimes stands up for itself and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes a text has embedded instructions in it about how it wants to be understood, and sometimes it doesn't. Over here in Sweden, you have, IMing. Do you ever use that phrase? Instant messaging. Do you do that over here on the internet?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Yeah, okay. I don't know so much about it. Sometimes any IMs I get very annoyed at because I don't like these IMs. But a lot of people like them. But I learned with these IMs, you can say something to someone with an IM, and you can say, I can't believe you did that. I'm going to kill you. And then you can put a little smiley face after that, which immediately alerts the receiver of such a message that you're actually not about to become a murderer to kill the other party to whom you are sending this instant message. But rather, it's sort of a very facetious statement. And it can even be affectionate. Sometimes the content of a message is not even nearly as powerful as the intent, indicated by other means, indicated by body language, indicated by expression, tone. But a text has a hard time speaking up for itself unless a text, in my opinion, is a little more sophisticated. The Bhagavad Gita is that kind of sophisticated text. It does say what it wants to say. The Sanskrit poet was certainly ingenious enough to not only say what it needed to say, but not to take little shortcuts and cheap little verse filler techniques, which is what we learned at Harvard in Sanskrit class, is that they will ignore a cha or an eva, some of these particle words, saying, oh, that's it, you can ignore that. That's just to fill up the verse. No. There are no verse fillers in these verses. Everything in poetry, if you take it seriously as poetry and as philosophy, everything there is extremely deliberate and philosophically and artistically or poetically strategized, if you will, or is very intentional. And to be demeaning in this way, which is the way I unfortunately learned, but I've now unlearned and relearned or newly learned through translations of this text, how to really see the text for what it is, what it's saying. So there are many new innovations that I've been undergoing in the whole art of translation that I will not bore any of you with here, especially most of you would not be Sanskritists. But suffice to say, the text has come alive for me in ways that are totally unexpected. After reading this text since I was 14 years old, I've been reading it since then, long time, the longest time, which can be good and which can be bad. You know, when you've been reading it that long, you think, oh, I know what the text says. And that's the way I started. Oh, I know what the text says. And I observed my own prejudice. You know, I said, okay, so you think you know what the text says. Let's see if you do. And that's how my venture began. And I found out that the text says a lot of what I thought it said, but not anything close to all that I found that it did say. I'm going to try to talk tonight a little bit about some of the things I found out that it did say that I not only did not know it said because of a lack of my own translation of ability, which evolved because of this challenge of doing this book, but also because I had not seen it in traditional commentaries and in various presentations of the Bhagavad Gita, translation or otherwise. So I was very surprised that even after several centuries of translating the Bhagavad Gita, either in scholarship or in sectarian context, that the Bhagavad Gita remained still a bit of a mystery, something hidden, something that could be mined further. So this was quite a pleasurable experience. One of the things I found in the Bhagavad Gita is that the book is essentially a book on yoga. I don't see the Bhagavad Gita generally presented as a book on yoga. Of course, what do we mean by yoga? Okay, well, why don't we all demonstrate that here? I want everyone to get up on the tables now, and I want everyone to get into Padmasana, lotus position, and let's do some deep breathing. Now, that's a later form of yoga. That's the third historical period of yoga. Yoga is something that goes back from the beginning of historical India, back as far as the Mohenjo-daro and Mohenjo-daro and the other one, civilization. Harappan civilization. Thank you. There goes my jet lag occasionally kicking in, folks. If I stand up here for more than 10 minutes of silence, would you please just give me a kick or a nudge? Would you do that, Fernando?
All right.
Thank you. But not too hard, okay? Okay, be gentle with me. It's been a hard night. The book is about yoga in the deepest and broadest sense of the term. One of the things I point out in my introduction is that the traditional titles of the Bhagavad Gita, although in the original text, is not presented at all with chapter titles because it's just numbered. But for the longest time, traditional commentators of the Bhagavad Gita and translators would present fairly standardized chapter titles. And what was interesting to me and fascinating to me about this is that somehow these translators or these transmitters of the Bhagavad Gita really did know it was about yoga, because every chapter title included the yoga of something, fill in the blank, the yoga of this, the yoga of that. Now, even in my own chapter titles for my translation, the Western eye hates so much repetition, so I don't list yoga in there at all, but I discuss that yoga is there in the chapter titles, traditionally, in every single chapter title. This is especially interesting to me with the first chapter. You can understand the second chapter, you know, Sankhya Yoga, the yoga of meditation, the yoga of knowledge, the yoga, this all sounds right, the yoga of the Supreme, even when it has to do with the divinity. The divinity also does yoga, apparently. We find out here the divinity performs yoga as much as souls perform yoga. But what's so interesting about the first chapter is this is the chapter in which Arjuna is confronted with this conflict in the outer world. So much so, he's presented with an ethical conflict, and as most of you know in the Bhagavad Gita, it opens up into a story that's already been occurring. So you're stepping into a story that's already been occurring, and for a Western reader, this is very troublesome. So it usually requires a little bit of introductory material, a little bit of background information, which I give. But what's interesting here is a very powerful opening of the Gita. Arjuna is a great warrior of the righteous army, and he is confronted about whether or not he should fight this war. He is struck with an irresolvable ethical conflict, and it's very clear that on a worldly level, it cannot be resolved. His conflict is, should I fight a battle with family, friends, and even gurus on the opposing side of the field? It says in the Dharma Shastras of India that you cannot, you must not, you should not kill, what to speak of, hurt family members, what to speak of, teachers. These days, students, sometimes they want to hurt their teachers. But back then, the teacher, the guru, this is it's inconceivable to hurt the guru. This is inconceivable. It's just the opposite. One reveres the guru. So on the one hand, he was stuck in a position of having to lead an army into battle to protect the innocent, which is the dharma, sacred calling, if you will, of a warrior. On the other hand, this warrior was breaking dharmic codes, ethical laws, by fighting such a war. So what to do? And that's, of course, the way the first verse opens up. How did these warriors act on this battlefield of Kurukshetra, in this holy place known as Kurukshetra? So there, the symbolism is so rich and so thick, we can't possibly go into all of it tonight. But the main point I'm trying to give to you is that this conflict that Arjuna was confronted with caused him to sink down into his chariot, the chariot that was being driven by Krishna, sink down into his chariot into a depression. And therefore, the first chapter title is called Arjuna Vishada Yoga, the yoga of Arjuna's depression. Talk about yoga being broadly conceived. Even depression can become a yoga. I just found that very, very intriguing. Yoga is anything that joins the individual self with the supreme self. It's not just getting on the table and doing yogasanas to lose weight, which is what we do in America. This is, you know. Now, I'm being a little facetious here, because many yoga practitioners now in this day and age are becoming very much aware that yoga comes from a very deep, a very profound tradition, going back thousands of years. And I'm invited regularly to yoga workshops, teacher training workshops, to talk about Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, talk about the Bhagavad Gita. And in fact, I'm quite in demand to do these sort of things, and I'll be doing more and more of them in the United States. So here, Arjuna Vishada Yoga. The Gita begins with an irresolvable ethical conflict that never gets resolved at an ethical level. It's an important statement. This is a very important statement. The Gita, in effect, is saying that ethics cannot do the job. There will be some ethical dilemmas that can never be resolved, that we'll have to take it to a higher level to address that conflict. And that's exactly what the Bhagavad Gita does. Krishna's teachings take Arjuna from this irresolvable ethical dilemma that caused him this depression, to sink into this depression, this despondency, and brought him into the inner world of transcendence, a world that's eternal, that goes beyond this temporary world, a world of flux and conflict, and then takes him even deeper to the innermost world of the heart. These three worlds, the outer world, the inner world, and the innermost world, is the way I kind of abbreviate this. It turns out that Krishna is speaking throughout the Gita, and again, you wouldn't know to really look for it unless you kind of looked for it. I don't know, that's probably a jet lag statement there, but that's all right, right? I'm being excused, right, for that sort of thing. It turns out that Krishna is presenting a supreme secret, he calls it. It's right there in his words, param guhyam, a supreme secret. This supreme secret consists of three dimensions: the secret, the greater secret, and the greatest secret of all. The 18th chapter reveals these three. The secret, you could call it the great secret or the secret, positive, right? Secret has to do with the outer world. How to act in the outer world in such a way as to blend your temporary activities with eternal significance, or leading to transcendent benefit. Actions, how to act in this world in relation to your eternal self. That's the first secret. The greater secret is how to know Supreme Spirit and Purushottama, the Supreme Self, and how to be devoted to that. How to offer one's heart to the Supreme Self, the Self that is indwelling, the indwelling Self, Purushottama. Often thought of as Paramatma, but not at that stage. There's no Paramatma in Bhagavad Gita. There is, but not with that nomenclature. Although the word appears, but it's used differently, and that's another interesting aspect. We'll get into that later. That's more for my technical Sanskrit buddies here, okay? But the third and greatest secret of all has to do with the divinity's passion for human hearts. And this I rarely ever see picked up in the Bhagavad Gita. Can we can you do your magical technological thing here? Oh, is it? Oh, I'm going to be zapped. Am I going to be zapped here? I'm going to come over here. Okay. Let's see what happens. Tapes it. Okay, that's fine. Basically, that's nice and big. Everyone can see it back there, right? This is the very first sort of famous verse of the Bhagavad Gita. Dharma kshetre kuru kshetre samaveta yoyotsavaha mamakam padavanschayava kimakurvata sanjaya. That's nice. Little music goes along with it. That was the camera, right? Yeah. What you have here is, again, a sense of the tension that's immediately present in the text. First verses of Sanskrit texts are well known for presenting, in some sense, the seed for the whole text. It's a very powerful technique used in Sanskrit dramaturgy. In fact, with my first book, I explain over maybe a dozen pages the significance of the first verse of that text, often known as a bija shloka. And this is one too. On the field of dharma, sacred place, the place known as Kurukshetra. Kurukshetra. Kuru is the common ancient ancestor belonging to both sides of the army. So this was a civil war. So there's this, joining of these two families. There's so much they have in common. And it's a sacred place. It's a holy place. A field of dharma. Assembled together, desiring to what? To fight? In a holy place? With family? Stood my armies, Dhritarashtra. He was the father of the sons leading the opposing army, the sort of evil army, the bad guys, the Kauravas. He was sitting there wondering what was happening in this arena, on the field of Kurukshetra. Stood my armies and indeed those of the sons of Pandu. How did they act? How did they act when they were there? This is so much of what the Gita is about. How to act in the most treacherous of world circumstances. We all have our own battlefields, ladies and gentlemen. Okay? It's just not happening at Kurukshetra. We all have our own battlefields. We're all a little bit like the king, Dhritarashtra. Blind kings in false kingdoms. We think that our worlds are going to last forever. We think that they belong to us. We think that we see them, but we're blinded to their temporariness. We're all a little bit like Dhritarashtra. And suddenly we're awakened a little bit by what's happening here in front of us. How did they act? O Sanjaya. So this is the very... by the way, you can sort of see my style of translation here. I call this dedicated free verse translation, where the it very much hugs the original Sanskrit. With the two leading lines shows the two beginnings of the two lines within the Sanskrit, and a kind of cascading indented phrases in the Sanskrit. Sanskrit is a language full of compound phrases, and to get that feeling across to an English reader, what I've tried to do here is to present these a kind of phraseological structure that would, in some sense, relate or convey the feeling that's there in the Sanskrit. And it's been received very, very well by my colleagues. And in the Princeton book, as well as this book, I talk about the problems of the free verse, free prose translation versus the constricted quatrain translation, where some scholars will try to just have four lines strictly, like there was in the Sanskrit, which you can't do because it takes many more English words to accurately translate Sanskrit verse. It's a highly inflected language. And then, of course, the prosaic translation being just sort of a rambling translation without any particular ordering or respect of the original ordering of the Sanskrit words. And this seems to solve the problems of both, and that's okay. That's the extent of your Sanskrit lesson today, no more. Okay? Good. Let's move on to some of the... Skip the footnotes. Skip the footnotes. It's just too much footnotes. Okay. Oh, skip these. We'll come back to these. No, keep going down. Yeah, there we go. That's good. Good. Okay. Oh, no, keep going. Yeah, keep going. We're going to go down to the 18th chapter here. Go. Oh, keep going. There we go. Yeah. Oh, okay. Now. Oh, yeah. Okay. There we go. No. A little bit different. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Here we go. Perfect. Okay. Here I'm going to sort of show you how this greatest secret emerges. I discovered that the 18th chapter, the final chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, is structured in four parts, essentially. First, the secret, for about 49 verses, the greater secret for about 13 or 14 verses, and then the greatest secret of all in 3 verses, and then the sort of finale, the concluding verses of the Gita. It's a very, very dramatic chapter. It is the longest chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, 78 verses. It is also the chapter that really seems to summarize the teachings of the Gita, rather than the second chapter, which is often called Summary of the Bhagavad Gita, somehow inscrutably, but for me. Here, in we can't tell what verse that is. That's verse 63, okay, of the 18th chapter. Thus for you this knowledge, which is a greater secret, than the previous secret, has been expounded upon by me. Having fully grasped this, with nothing overlooked, then act as you so choose. Remember in the first verse? How did they act, O Sanjaya? We're coming back to this in some sort of a very dramatic way. Then Krishna is saying, now you should act. Once you know all of this, once you've heard this supreme secret and all that it makes up, now you can act as you so choose. Now you have the freedom. Now you have the free will to act in a way that you know is best. So here, Krishna is very clearly labeling the secret, the greater secret. I had to go back into the 18th chapter to figure out where does that begin, where does it start, where does it end. And I outline that in my introduction to the Gita. And if we can go down now, and here is the, you know, oh, yeah, good. Don't go any further. That's good. Good, good. Here is the presentation of, well, let's just let Krishna explain to us what it is. Here, once again, the greatest secret of all, my supreme message. Now, can you be more emphatic than this? I don't know. Do we need smiley faces on top of all this? I don't know. I don't think so. And then quotations are used. Quotation marks are used with the word itti. I always use the quotation marks first with itti. Ishtosi me dritam itti. You are so much loved by me. Therefore, I shall speak of your ultimate good. We find in the Bhagavad Gita that Krishna is not a god of judgment. He is not a jealous god. He is not a god of punishment. This is not the kind of god Krishna is. God here is a god that wants the love of souls without coercion, without manipulation, without force. Because what kind of love would that be? I give a very simple example to my students so they really get the idea. I tell my students, look, I want all of you to love me as your favorite professor, and if you don't, I'll kill you. So, let's say they start loving me as their favorite professor. They're only doing that because they're afraid that I'm going to, you know, kill them. What kind of love is that? I sometimes tell my students, you know, sometimes when I'm walking across campus, I hear some young man or young woman say, he better love me or I'll kill him. And I'm thinking, okay, that's an interesting motivation to love. So what we have here is a gentle deity. We have a gentle deity, a generous deity. A deity who loves us, apparently, has a passion in his love for us, which is so hard to get across in the translation of Ishtosi me dritam itti. And I go through it in my introduction. And it's the kind of case where we have a kind of unremitting love. Unrequited love of divinity for souls. He loves us, but we don't love him. It's a problem. Have you ever loved someone who didn't love you back? Well, there are a few ways you can go about this. So Ferdinando. Take Ferdinando. I've been picking on him all day. So let me do it some more. I love Ferdinando. I love him greatly as my dear friend. But he doesn't know that. Now I can say, Ferdinando, you don't know this, but I love you like crazy, man. You're my best friend ever. And, you know, he could say, well, I mean, that could be a little uncomfortable for him because it's not like, well, first of all, he doesn't even know me that well. And that's the same thing for souls. We don't know the divinity that well to be able to say that. So much of the Gita is about knowing divinity. Much of Krishna's words are declarational words, where he speaks about himself in the first person. Many of his words are also exhortative words. And I go through the different kinds of expressions there. But ultimately, he is loving us without our loving him. That's why he keeps it a secret. I'm not going to tell Ferdinando how much I love him, because that would put undue pressure on him. He would feel obligated, especially since I'm on his dissertation committee. But that's another issue. But that's another issue entirely. But the idea is that would be force.
See? I love you so much.
Oh, yeah. See, it really works. That's more the Western approach. That's more the Western divinity approach, right? I fear you, therefore I love you. Right? Krishna does not want souls to fear him and to therefore love him. He doesn't want the love precipitated out of fear. So he keeps it a secret. I will love you souls but I will not tell you so directly. Because I want, oh, I can hear better now. My ears just popped from the flights. Okay, sorry about that. Just suddenly, have I been talking too loudly all this time? Probably have been. Okay, anyway, again, a little bit of the jet lag experience coming through here. But anyway, the idea then is that Krishna is very clearly announcing that he keeps his love secret to preserve the purity of the love of souls when they do love him. It's just, now, that's my interpretation of why he keeps it secret, but there's no question that the text itself talks about this divine secrecy. So, when we talk about the Bhagavad Gita as a yoga, we're talking about a yoga, ultimately, of divine love. We're talking about something similar to what we were talking about earlier in the previous talk, which is here, if we look hard enough, we're talking about a marriage between souls and the Supreme Soul. We're talking about an intimate connection, a yoga, between soul and Supreme Soul. One of the ways, I'll give you one more little tiny Sanskrit lesson, even though I promised I would stop. But one of the things that you find throughout the Gita that I didn't expect is the verbal form of yoga. Everyone knows the form of yoga. Everyone knows the word yoga. But what about the verbal form of yoga? Yukta. So what that really means is yogad. You know, if someone is yogad. But you can't say yogad. You can't yoga. You do yoga, okay? So you have to supply a verb with yoga to translate the verb yukta. But other translators drop the idea of yoga, not acknowledging its derivative root form, yuj, from which yoga comes, its noun form comes. And they put some translation out like connected or engaged or some such weaker substitution. I translate it as one who is absorbed in yoga. One absorbed in yoga. And there are various reasons for that, and I won't go into those details. But the word absorbed is important because it relates to the highest level of the Ashtanga system, which is samadhi, which has to do with absorption in the object of meditation. So absorbed in yoga. And when one translates the Gita with all of the words of yoga, verbal and noun forms, one suddenly realizes how pervasive the whole idea of yoga is. And one of the things I like to point out is how yoga is at various levels. Yoga can be there at a dharmic level, yoga in the outer world, yoga can be there at a transcendent level, and yoga then ultimately is at that innermost world level, yoga between the divinity, the heart of divinity, and the hearts of souls. Go to the next verse, if you will. The next two verses are, again, the spelling out further of the supreme secret, of the ultimate, the greatest secret of all. Be mindful of me with love offered to me. With love offered to me translates bhakta, past passive participle, bhakta. Sacrificing to me, offer homage unto me, surely you shall come to me. This phrase right here, come to me. I've counted 15 or 16 different times where Krishna, throughout the text, talks about souls coming to him. A nearness, a proximity, souls coming closer to him. Again, this kind of divine intimacy expressed powerfully throughout the Gita. This, I promise you, for you are dearly loved by me. Again, reinforcing the ultimate statement of the first verse. Now let's go down to the verse that has come to be known as the Charama Shloka since Ramanujacharya of the 11th century. This is traditionally considered the sort of ultimate verse. I consider all three of these verses as the denouement, you know, as the real sort of finale, the ultimate statements in Krishna's words, in his teachings. Abandoning completely all forms of dharma. Come to me. Here we go again. Come to me. Again. Repeated in these two verses. Very powerful. Bless you. Come to me as your only refuge. I shall grant you freedom from all misfortune. Do not despair. Yoga, basically, and I'm going to just wind this up so we can, again, we can have some time for some discussion. Yoga then becomes something that joins intimately. It never dissolves identities. It's never a monism. I try to point out that so many people point out that yoga comes from the word, verb root yuj, which means, or yoga, the word yoke in English is a cognate of the word yoga. Everyone is so happy to point that out. But I take it a little further. What is a yoke? Let me just ask any of you. It's always interesting to ask this. The noun yolk. What is a yolk? And I'm not talking about the egg yolk. Okay? What is a yolk? Anyone know?
Egg joins two boxes together.
Oh, okay, okay, go back. This is good. It does what now? It joins
together.
Joins together what?
Well, I think it's usually a horse or oxen or,
two. The stuff, right there. Thank you. You gave me everything I needed, okay? A plus. Can you give her a grade or something? That's right. Exactly. A lot of people think that it just holds one, a harness, a crossbar of some kind, holds an ox. But the dictionary definition makes it very clear. It's a crossbar that holds two oxen or two farm animals. Now, I'm no farmer, but that's the meaning of yoke. Okay? So, and yoga is exactly, there's so much that's illuminating in the definition of the English cognate to understand the Sanskrit word yoga. Yoga is that force that brings together two souls, individual and divine, into an intimate union or joining. That's what yoga is about. That's the essence of yoga. That's what the Bhagavad Gita focuses on. Now, there are many ways. Krishna, again, is a very generous deity. He even says if you want to worship other deities, other divinities, that's fine. He'll help you. Were this the Hebrew Bible, you would get quite a different response from the divinity. He would tell other people to go and kill them. The divinity here is a very generous, very patient deity, waiting for the hearts of souls to turn to the divine heart. It's really quite an amazing text when you think of it in these terms. And ultimately, it's this yoga, bringing together the hearts of humans with the hearts of with the heart of divinity. And that is the ultimate meaning of yoga as defined by the Bhagavad Gita. Without going into the other verses right now, why don't I just stop there, and just because I've been talking plenty long here, and you're all very, very patient. I hope you're not getting the sleep there that I need to be getting here. But anyway, any comments or clarifications required or needed or any questions whatsoever? Does it make sense what I'm saying? Is it pretty clear? Is it cogent? I don't know if I'm speaking cogently or not. It's pretty clear?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, please.
Just one thing that may be a bit technical, but to tie together two things you were talking about, this idea of there being no filler.
Yeah.
In the very deliberateness of the Gita and your attempt in the translation that you've done to draw out, in a sense to milk every bit that's there.
Yeah.
And this emphasis on the idea of yoga and its presence in the Gita. And one just thing that struck me is how you would deal with when, for instance, the first the first passage of the second chapter, where there are phrases such as yogam yumjam.
Yes. Yes, right. It looks like it could be appearing to be a redundancy or tautology. Yeah. And then, of course, yoga yukta is also there.
Yeah.
That phrase appears a couple of times. Well, you'll just have to get a copy of the book when it comes out. Basically, I'd have to show you the different instances, but I also thought that that would be a problem, because I was aware of those constructions.
Yeah.
But in fact, again, something different comes out when you when you really are committed to this. There's also a verse in the Gita that every translator shies away from, because it repeats one word as many as seven times, and a significant word at that, atma, self. And if you know Sanskrit, the word atma can mean many different things. It can mean self, it can mean soul, it can mean mind, it can mean body, it can mean heart. It can mean all of these things. That's why I choose the word self, because self seems to contain all of these things. But when you hear it in the Sanskrit, you hear the word atma seven times. But in the English, in so many English translations, you hear compromise, dancing around with all kinds of interpretations. Whereas I managed to come up with what I think is a very convincing translation, consistently utilizing the word self each time. So it stays consistent with what the Sanskrit's doing in the English. Not easy to do. Took me 2 weeks to do that verse. Again, the Bhagavad Gita is well known to be really fairly reasonable Sanskrit. It is not difficult Sanskrit, not the way the Princeton book is. Very, very difficult. The Sanskrit there is difficult because it's poetic and it's a lot of kavya conventions and Natya Shastra, and it's complicated. And the Sanskrit itself is very difficult. Bhagavad Gita is not like that. But the Bhagavad Gita challenges us in terms of the eloquence and the simplicity of its constructions and the depth of the philosophical meaning of the text. So it's quite challenging. So a lot of wonderful challenges like that. Yeah.
I want to elaborate a little bit on this point, how Krishna keeps his love secret to preserve the purity of the love of the souls.
Yes. You want me to...
In what sense? How does him keeping his love secret preserve the love, the purity?
Well, there are many reasons why someone keeps something secret. You keep something secret because you do want to protect it. For example, in the fourth chapter, as you may know, Krishna says that this ancient teaching of yoga was lost. And he comes to give it back. So that's a very interesting... Krishna also says that of secrets... He is silence. He is silence. So there's really a special relationship going on here with the divinity and with secrecy. Very interesting. And I think it's there because it protects this love. It preserves the purity of it. It shows an enormous amount of compassion, divine compassion for souls. An enormous amount of inclusivity. He doesn't say his way is the one only way. It's a very different portrait of divinity than what we have in the Abrahamic Western traditions. It's very interesting. And again, if we do what I'm suggesting that we do in the earlier talk, that is to find the great gifts of the heart in different religious traditions, I think this tradition has an awful lot to offer.
Thank you.
Not that the others don't. No, my premise is that every single tradition has, like, for example, I said that Krishna is not a jealous God. You know, God himself says in the Decalogue, I am a jealous God. He comes right out and says, I am a jealous God. But you know what? That can also be good too. And how they take it, you see. It's up to them to pursue that. Now, I can think of any number of ways how a jealous God could be a wonderful God. So I'm not criticizing it. I'm contrasting it. You see? So there's a difference. Let me just make sure if there's anyone else.
What about this other yoga system? Because you were saying the most secret part of the Gita is the end of the 18th chapter. And so
yes.
There is a whole complex of, as you mentioned, different kinds of yogas, karma yoga, jnana yoga, Dhyana yoga and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So how you see, is it Krishna trying to build up a staircase or something? Or how or are these just different approaches to the divine?
Yes. It is a bit of a staircase. I mean, he does say the great secret, the greater secret, you know, guyatara, guyatamam. I mean, that's a staircase. I mean, there's a hierarchy there. There's a preference there. But he also understands that you may not be able to go to Guhyatamam without going to Guhya first. You may need to progress gradually. I think there's a strong element of that there, an intention that one has to progress upward. And then once you do get all the way to the greatest secret of all, what happens? Arjuna returns to the outer world of conflict. It comes back to these irresolvable ethical conflicts. These painful situations, these treacherous events of this world, with a new found inner strength. It's a very interesting statement, really, the Gita is making. We're not going to resolve this at a utilitarian ethical level, at a deontological ethical level, at a virtue ethical level. No. All of these different kinds of ethics, you can analyze the ethical situation to death. Krishna says, in fact, there are so many arguments that Arjuna gives that cover all of these Western sort of formulae for ethical stances. They're exhausted. They don't work. There's no way to resolve it. The only thing to do is to go to transcendent levels and then to return to this world with a renewed vision, a vision of the heart. Yeah.
I'm curious with
Patanjali's,
what is it,
eight limbs
Of yoga. How would the great, greater, and greatest secret correspond to those eight levels of yoga?
Well, I don't know that they do, except that Patanjali himself says, Samadhi Siddhi Ishwara Pranidhanat. That of the eight limbs, of course, samadhi is the ultimate. Samadhi, for those of you who don't know, is that state of meditation in which the meditator loses complete awareness of him or herself and is utterly absorbed in the object of meditation. The Gita talks about such samadhi in terms of bhakti. One is totally, it's an utterly and totally theocentric orientation. That's the dhyana there. But Patanjali says, samadhi siddhi, he says the perfection of the perfection of the eight limbs is itself dedication to the Supreme. So samadhi is dedication to the Supreme, Patanjali says, and Krishna elaborates on that throughout the whole Gita. What Krishna is saying is that it may take some preliminary steps. I think Patanjali's Ashtanga system is another way to kind of progress toward that. But it doesn't so deliberately in terms of the pranidhana. It doesn't so deliberately in terms of the bhakti. The Bhagavad Gita is the first place where bhakti, or the offering of one's heart to the divine is really the first major statement in all of sacred literature of India that establishes that. And Patanjali doesn't focus so much on that. He focuses more on the technology of mental and physical discipline, even ethical discipline. Yama niyama, you know, restrictions and observances, those are ethical dimensions of yoga.
So it's not the situation that each of those, like dhyana and then the others, would lead to either the greater or greater state?
Actually, now that you're bringing this up, you're kind of making me think that it does. Because the first three of the Ashtanga system, the having to do with restrictions, observances, and bodily positions, asana, are very much in the external world. I mean, that's very much dealing with externals, things of the world. And then you've got the pranayama, pratyahara. Pranayama, the regulation of the, pratyahara comes first, right? Right, then pranayama. No, pranayama comes first, then pratyahara. Sorry, pratyahara. In other words, there is the withdrawal of the senses from sense objects, the going within to more transcendent levels.
So that would correspond to the greater.
Yes. And then finally with samadhi, then there's the dharana, concentration, dhyana, meditation. And in samadhi, that's where the greatest secret begins. But he describes that as Ishwara Pranidhana. It doesn't really go into that. That's where the Gita takes over. So yes, I think that the three are there. I think they can be understood there. But the greatest secret of all is not pursued there much at all. It is tokenistically presented. That is because Patanjali emphasizes the outer world and the inner world of yoga, of the Ashtanga type of yoga. Yeah. It's very interesting. I haven't quite put it together that way. It's good. Any other comments or points? Yeah.
I have something more. I'm trying to understand these ethics because you said something about the kind of making ethical choices out of the heart.
Yes.
Being connected to the heart. In the case of Arjuna and Krishna, it seems like pretty obvious because Krishna was right there and it was kind of guiding Arjuna.
Yes.
It was a very one-to-one relationship. But then I'm trying to apply to what you were saying about making ethical choices and what yoga is about.
Yes.
How does that relate to everyday life choices? If we want to understand what the Gita is trying to say, we can reproduce the scene of Krishna being there and, you know, connecting directly to yoga. So how is that? What does the Gita try to say
beyond
that situation?
Oh, this is a very interesting question, and I think that you're not necessarily entirely right. We can't reproduce what Arjuna has there because, in fact, we have our own battlefields, is my contention. We have our struggles, our challenges. All the time in this world, we are challenged by irresolvable ethical decisions and questions and issues. So we certainly have the outer conflicts. There's no shortage of those. We all have them. And then you may be saying, well, where's Krishna? I mean, it would be nice to have him turn to us and tell us all these things. Well, that's the whole point of the Gita. Arjuna is, in some sense, standing in for us. That's, I think, what the tradition would say. He's the paradigmatic human. He's the one who's getting these instructions. Now we can hear them through Arjuna. And in a sense, Sanjaya, is he talking to me? He's motioning to someone else. I didn't see the someone else. Okay. I thought he was trying to communicate with me. I thought I had some divine dispensation coming to me. But again, jet lag, you know, can you start seeing things with sleep deprivation. I'm telling you, I you have no idea how all of you look to me right now. I mean, and I won't say how good or how bad, okay? I'm just going to leave it at that. So the idea then is I think that with Sanjaya, also becomes a kind of model figure, the narrator of this inner dialogue. Sanjaya, who has this extra vision, to be able to see on the battlefield. Remember, Sanjaya is the minister of Dhritarashtra. Now, I explain all this. This is a kind of complex sort of literary structure here. But Sanjaya is the minister sitting with Dhritarashtra in the palace, asking, who's being asked by Dhritarashtra, how did they act on the battlefield? Sanjaya can see and hear remotely even better than anyone else can hear on the battlefield or see on the battlefield. He's privy by the grace of Vyasa, Vyasa Prasada, Shrutavan, it's explained in the last, in the 18th chapter, how it is he's given a special power to see on the battlefield. Now, what does this mean? This means, I think, to the tradition that we can, in some sense, be Sanjaya-like and see what's going on the battlefield through Sanjaya. We can be a little tiny Sanjayas, you see, and be able to witness. Or we can be little Dhritarashtras, a blind kings in our, you know, in our false kingdoms, and be transformed into little Sanjayas. There's just a lot of very beautiful sort of tropes that hit you, that make this text a very rich, poetic as well as philosophical text. And really, in India, what makes these texts so, so powerful is this combination of the poetic and the philosophical. Beautiful. There's nothing quite like it. So, I might disagree with you, Ferdinando. I think that we're on our chariots, we got our depressions, our challenges, and we can perceive what Krishna is going to tell us through Sanjaya. And I think that's why it's couched, why this inner dialogue between Arjuna and Krishna is couched within this outer dialogue, this outer narrative between Dhritarashtra and Sanjaya. It's an inner dialogue that we're meant to carry with us. So I disagree. How about that? Any other comments or observations, disputations, gripes? Yes, a gripe from you, yes.
Krishna talks about the parampara in the fourth chapter.
Yes.
In the means of passing on this knowledge generation after generation, preserving it. And yet we see something which you've been also demonstrating here, a dynamics in the Gita where you might be able to see things which others haven't seen before. Do these two like contradict each other, preserving and at the same time finding new things in a way surpassing the previous teachers?
I wonder how the tradition would perceive this. I don't know that they would view it as a surpassing, but rather there is an already built into the tradition a constant revisioning of the tradition. With the Princeton book, there is of course the discussion on Shukadev, of which you might be quite familiar, where Shuka is repeating things, but making them all the more beautiful. And of course the name parrot, Shuka means parrot, and it's believed that when the parrot bites into the mango is sweeter. Although I've never tested that out in India when I've been there, I've never actually plucked a mango that has been previously already partially digested by a parrot. I haven't tested this. I haven't done that kind of field work, so I can't be called on that. But, however, that's the understanding. And this is the tradition. Even with the Bhagavat itself, the author of the Bhagavat, author Vyasa, was dissatisfied. He wrote the Bhagavat because these were stories that already had been told, but now he's telling them anew, better, in their better way. There's a constant revisioning, greater and greater redactions of stories, of texts, that can then be more deeply understood and pursued. I think it's in the spirit of the tradition, to be able to see, to find endless depths of it. I don't think it's in competition or a kind of superseding. I think it's more of a serving. I would hope that practitioners would see my work that way. I would hope they would see that. Yeah.
I'm just thinking in work that I've done with Baladevi Bhushana's commentary on the Gita, I was very sort of astonished and didn't quite know what to do when I ran into his final verse in the summary of his commentary, because he basically says something about may the sadhus shodaya, I think is the word he uses, purify or somehow cleanse or make better this commentary. And it's just this idea that here he is, he's definitely, he has something to say, he has people that he's arguing against quite
vehemently.
Yeah, and then he's going on to say, let someone else fix my work.
Uh-huh.
And when I looked at the way that he had related his commentary to one of his predecessors, Ramanuja,
yes,
that I could see exactly in that the example of what he was looking for, and it's just this idea. He didn't necessarily try to supersede or outdo her, but he took some of the ideas that had already been developed by Ramanuja, but definitely gave a whole new angle on how to look at certain aspects of the Bhagavad Gita.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think that's... I appreciate that comment very much, because, again, I think it's in the service of what has been said, by bringing out new things, reinforcing, not altering. Not correcting, but just a further flowering of the tradition. So I think it's that speaks well to that, what Baladev Vidyabhushana does. Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah. And I mean, my gosh, this is what we do in scholarship, hopefully, if scholars can behave themselves with each other. I mean, if there's the proper etiquette between scholars, and I think there is a good amount, even internationally, I think that we all appreciate what each other is doing. But when someone corrects something, I don't think they're trying it. I don't think it's one-upsmanship. I think it's, let's get this thing right together. So even asserting something that's wrong is a contribution, because then it can be corrected and bettered. So this afternoon, I threw out a thesis toward all of you, which I didn't have time to completely put out. I had a lot of information left, but someday you may see it in print, and you may say, well, I can agree with Schweig on this point, but frankly, I think he's completely off his rocker, and I think that jet lag really got the best of him. And I'm going to vehemently disagree with him. And that would be good. I don't think it's... Again, done in the spirit of scholarship, I think colleagues here and abroad would also agree with me that I think there's a cumulative... What one teacher of mine at Harvard, Wilfred Cantwell Smith, talked about as the cumulative tradition, that there's a kind of building and refining. It's like taking a stone and polishing it more and more and more till the glow comes out. No. That was my, yeah, sorry, yeah. That was my commentary on my teacher's statement. Yeah, he called me on it. See how we correct each other? It's very good, very good. No, I think that the academic tradition is not unlike the traditional religious traditions, traditional religious tradition. The traditional religious kind of parampara, this handing down. It's not just handing down and not doing anything with it. It's handing down and doing something with it. It's a building up. Parampara almost has a feeling of like a gaining momentum. Not like kind of, not winding down, the spring is running out, but rather it's a building up a greater momentum, a greater flowering, a greater flourishing of the tradition. Just even with Ferdinando's thesis, for example. This will further scholarship and hopefully also enlighten and contribute something to practitioners as well. That was something that Wilfred Cantwell Smith also taught me. It's one of the reasons why I wanted to go to Harvard rather than to Chicago, by the way, because they didn't have that attitude in Chicago. But it should be something. If what we do in scholarship should not be so isolated and so self-serving and myopic that it doesn't have some value for those who live the life. This is you know, we're not serving scholarship well if we do that, and we're not serving because then we're so out of touch. Then we become that bad reputation we have. Oh, you're just being a scholar. You know, an armchair. You're an armchair scholar. You're in your ivory tower, Schweig. Okay, right? You're so disconnected with what people are doing. You're so full of your own ideas. You don't have anything that connects with reality at all, jet lag or not. So the idea then is, there's a balance, I think. And it behooves traditions, and I guess I was trying to say this earlier, it behooves persons within traditions, religious traditions, to communicate those great gifts found deep within their traditions to those outside their traditions. Maybe if they're not scholars, that's fine. But we again, we need to be careful of this isolation due to insecurity, this fundamental insecurity with which humans are so often plagued. And that's an act of love, going beyond the boundaries. We can call that boundless love. And I speak about this in the Princeton book, the nature of boundless love. I have a little section there called Ethical Boundaries and Boundless Love, and the tension between the two. Have I totally exhausted everybody? Or any other comments or from anyone that we haven't heard from yet? Ruchia? Anything? No? Okay. Good. Well, I failed to give everyone a break, so maybe this is a good time to... How are we doing?
Yeah, we have like 20 minutes.
20 minutes?
No, I mean, till 8 o'clock.
Okay, technically. Well, you know what we could do is just informally just hang around here a little bit and just officially... What do you think?
Yeah, that could be good, yeah.
Should they end?
And then, yeah.
And in case I pass out of sheer, then it's all right. In other words, it will not have hurt the main.
You've done your duty.
You see, yeah. If I pass out, then the others who do remain here can help revive me and so on. Right? Is that right? But thank you very much.
And thank you so much for despite the jet lag.
Yes. No problem.
Enlightening us and giving us so much of your scholarship. That's a nice way. Thank
you
very much.
Thank you. So I'm going to be hanging out here for a bit if anyone wants to.